What are the most common excuses we use to avoid doing what God has called us to do? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Paul Dibdahl, host and study guide author for this 13-week series on mission. And I'm joined today by two colleagues and friends from the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, Dave Thomas and Brant Berglund. Thank you both for joining me. So what are those? The leading question, the most common excuses we use for avoiding what God has called us to do. Think of some common ways in which people respond. When God says, I want you to do this, and we don't want to.
I think the quickest response is some people just put their fingers in their ears and pretend they didn't hear it. It's not as much as an excuse, but maybe there's excuses that underlie that, and maybe that's where you're going. But I think people put their fingers in their ears and say, I didn't hear you.
I think people are often afraid. Yeah. They're afraid of the unknown, or they're afraid of the task, or they're afraid of upsetting the status quo that they are involved in at the moment.
A loss of comfort, a loss, knowing you've mentioned in previous conversations that we've had, Paul, about being in Thailand where meager meals, change of culture, change of language, I'm very uncomfortable in other cultures where I don't speak the language. And even until I learn the language, I would be very frustrated. And that drives me crazy.
Yeah. I think I'm not adequately prepared is another.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm not properly qualified. I can't speak well.
Think of how the prophets responded. I'm too young.
I don't speak well.
Yeah, I don't speak well. Send someone else. I'm not capable. You must have the wrong person.
I'm just a shepherd. Yeah. I'm a farmer.
Jeremiah, Lord, send somebody else.
Yep. And I feel like today, and maybe this is me, my standard answer, but sometimes we remind God that we're really busy with a lot of other good things.
For him.
Yeah, for him. So we really couldn't take on this this new calling.
Is it possible sometimes that the excuse is, I feel you've called me here. It can't be you calling because you already have put me in a place where I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
Mm. So with this kind of lead-in, receiving a calling from God that maybe we weren't so excited about hearing, we turn our attention this week to the book of Jonah. Four chapters, we're not going to be able to cover all of it, not even close to that. But let's just start off with a little background here. God calls Jonah, prophet Jonah, to go to Nineveh. It was a principal city in Assyria, at that time a feared and hated enemy of Israel. Assyrians were noted in the ancient world for their cruelty. Later in the Bible, Nahum, another prophet, later lists Nineveh's sins, in case we were wondering, plotting evil, gratuitous cruelty in war, sexual immorality, witchcraft, commercial injustice, and exploitation. And God calls Jonah to go to that city, to Nineveh. So, Adventists, Seventh-day Adventists, have often focused on withdrawing from places of vice and cities in particular. And we've been encouraged. I just grew up sort of understanding that the simple rural life was the ideal life. Today, more than half of the world lives in an urban area. So how can we balance this call to reach people where they are with the idea that you have to be careful of your association with the vice that is in cities? Help us think our way through this.
I don't know that I can help a lot because I struggle with the dichotomy. I grew up in a small town. I'm a country boy. I prefer living where there's tractors and farms, and yet I do love the communion of like-minded people. I think that kind of fellowship is beautiful. And when I go into the city, for instance, when I drive to Seattle, I'm driving down I-90, down out of the mountains, and as I start hitting North Bend and Issaquah, my shoulders tense up, I get into the traffic, and I just want to leave the city, even when I'm there to see dear friends, right? But I look around me and I realize when we were in Egypt this summer, we were in Cairo, and tens of miles from one side to the other and millions of people. And it's like these people need to know the love of Jesus too. And how would I minister to this? I don't know. I wouldn't know where to start.
Well, I think these strategies need to come from people who are urban. more than people who are rural. How do you reach the cities? I look at, for example, Rio de Janeiro and some of those big cities in South America where they have established churches in almost every block. But people who live there are doing this, see? And so I remember reading or seeing an article where the Hispanic community in New York City had a big parade, and I think thousands of people showed up and said, God is welcome in our city. Hmm. So, I mean, they have a strategy for doing that. I don't understand the city, but I recognize that the world is becoming more and more urban, and so it has to be – I think you have to live there in order to be effective. I don't think you can live outside and affect the city.
That was my question, Dave. You know, is it possible to live – up the hill a little ways and then drive into town to do your ministry? But I think you need to live with the people you minister to. I even struggled with this when I pastored. You had people who came from another town with a church to my church. And it's like, I want you to stay where you are and minister where you are to those people. Not that I don't mind my church growing, but I'd rather.
Which is why Jesus told the demoniac to stay where he was, because he had already a reputation, and the change that people would see would be so obvious they would be potentially dramatically affected by his presence.
Yeah. And the Samaritan woman in John 4, right? Go and tell. She went and told the whole village, her whole town.
Yeah. I'll try to emphasize that this point, which I think is important, is that today, if we talk about the frontiers of mission, we should not imagine a country scene, a jungle, someone in a pair of shorts and a pith helmet, to use really dated
going
imagery.
Across the ocean.
The frontier of mission is in the cities. That's where the unreached people are. Not just a few of them, but millions upon millions of people are in urban areas. Why was it that Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh? Was it fear of the Ninevites, or was it hatred for the Ninevites?
It's hard for me to decipher that, Paul. Okay.
I think the end of the book tells us, though. He says, after God spares the city, when the prophecy doesn't come true, he says, I knew you were like this, God. I knew that you forgave sins, and I knew that if they turned and repented, you'd give them another chance, and that's not what I wanted.
Yeah,
I wanted you to wipe them off the
face. So it was hatred.
I think it was a combination of both. I mean, when you read about the ancient Assyrians, they were a nasty bunch. They treated people extremely badly. I mean, impaling them and torturing them and all kinds of
things. Flaying the skin from their bodies while they were alive.
I think Jonah was afraid of that. But I think also he was hoping, well, boy, this is a good day. The Ninevites are going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
That's quite a complaint he has about God at the end of the book. I was amused when I read that. God, I knew you were kind and merciful.
This is what I was afraid, you were going to go easy on them, and you really shouldn't. Yeah, you really shouldn't. Throughout the book, there's this contrast between Jonah, the prophet of Yahweh, prophet of the Lord, and then the I'll just say pagans. I'll use that term to describe them. So the sailors on the boat. And then the people of Nineveh, even the animals of Nineveh, right?
Cloaked in sackcloth.
Sackcloth and ashes and fasting. Both humans and animals fasted. And in contrast, you have the prophet of the Lord who, while the pagan sailors are praying to their gods, he's sleeping. He says, throw me in. And they want to save his life more than he wants to save his own life. Yeah. We just go on. Even to the plant that grows is doing the will of God, which is what Jonah has been refusing to do all along.
Right.
So this contrast between the heathens or the pagans and the prophet of God, any lessons that we learn from this? The heathens end up, quote-unquote heathens, end up looking so much better than the Lord's prophet. Lesson for us.
Huh. The response to the call of God. God is looking for all of us to respond in the level to which we're called. Is it true for Jonah that to the one who has, more will be given? Is that?
See, I wonder if it isn't that for the Ninevites, this was a brand new love experience that had an effervescence to it. For the sailors, I'd have to think about it some more. But for the Ninevites, this was news that turned out to be for their redemption. You can expect a very high level of devotion. For Jonah, it's kind of old hat. He's been doing this all his life. I mean, not known about this. And so it's not like it's a new or novel thing that makes a big difference in his life.
But the great irony then, Paul, in what you're saying is that Jonah, if he'd only looked around him, the responsiveness of everyone around him was far greater than he thought, right? He didn't realize how ready people were.
I thought, you know, a modern evangelist would be overjoyed if that kind of reaction took place.
Yeah.
But that's where I think the animosity shows up in Jonah.
Yeah. Are there people that we don't, and bringing it to today, are there people that we don't want God to have mercy on? And it would be risky for us to acknowledge that, but are there people they really deserve to be destroyed? The horror that they've brought to people around them, to innocent people, and really that we do want them to be destroyed. Are there not
the Manasses like of that? The world who have been so evil? We just wish they would get their just desserts.
Yeah.
See, I don't. I gave up that kind of thought a long time ago because I think that human knowledge is too partial to make that kind of judgment. Plus, as a theologian, I would like everybody to be saved. And so I find it hard to wish destruction on people. This is why I changed my opinion about the death penalty. I don't like the death penalty anymore.
But I would also say there's a lesson in this that is easy, I think, for what you said, Dave. You don't want to see anybody perish. And I think that is true when we think about people as individuals. But we have been in some ways indoctrinated to think about people according to their group identities. And then we can say, I want everybody to be saved, but I want that group gone. And that's, I think, dangerous when we stop seeing people as individuals, but as part of a group. And then I can say, well, that group can go. I wish everyone were saved, but that group, no. And I think that's dangerous. Maybe that's saying too much, but
I'm going to the last question as we close. Who changed most in the story? Was it Jonah or the people of Nineveh?
The only evidence we have that Jonah changed is that the book got written.
So whether he did or didn't is it's maybe slightly obscure.
It seems to me that the degree of change was much bigger in the Ninevites than for Jonah. Jonah had a change of heart, I hope. But the Ninevites had a whole change of life.
Jonah went, but he was still belligerent and going. It didn't change his attitude. It just changed whether he would go or not.
Yeah. And maybe this speaks again to an issue about – we talked about the Great Commission a couple of weeks back and disciples doubting and still they're sent. And here we have a prophet who is unwilling with a bad attitude, and yet God still works through him to bring about the salvation of a whole city. God is compassionate and gracious for sure. Thank you, Brent and Dave, for your conversation, your input today. Thank you also to Rick Baskett and Naomi Cueto, our programming engineers. And finally, thank you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.